kind of a older saying that when people were kind of upset with you, you might say something like, just build a bridge and get over it. That really doesn't work today. We're going to come to the climax of what we've been building towards over the last few weeks. Jacob and Esau are finally going to have that conversation. So I want to frame our discussion by just kind of drawing us back to ourselves and thinking perhaps about a time you offended somebody. And it might have been a big deal, it might not have, but I think all of us could draw to mind something we said. That's usually mine. I use a lot of words. And so the more you talk, just the odds of you saying something you shouldn't increase. And I tend to have a sort of a sarcastic side to me, especially in moments of tension or frustration. I'm not one of those guys that sort of lashes out in anger. I usually kind of diffuse things with humor. And sometimes I'm the only one that thinks it's funny. And after I say it, even then I realize that it wasn't all that funny. But that might not be you. So maybe you've done something, some act unkindly towards another. You know, sometimes these things are not big deals, right? You do it to somebody hopefully you have a good relationship with, and your love for one another kind of overcomes that, and so you just kind of let it go. That's 40 years of my marriage in a nutshell. Other times, though, it's a bigger deal. Right, it's something that maybe with a sibling or an employer or something that just kind of causes a break in a relationship, a coworker that doesn't come together right away. Right, saying sorry just doesn't quite put it back together. So I want to kind of frame our conversation that way this morning, because that's what we're going to talk about. So we're in chapter 33. Now we're going to go through the whole chapter today, 20 verses. And just to kind of, again, bring us up to speed, Jacob is preparing to meet his brother Esau. Remember, this is the brother, you know, the backstory of this is the brother that he had tricked out of the birthright, kind of trading off that, taking advantage of Esau's hunger and kind of giving him a pot of stew, only if he gave him the birthright, rather than just saying, oh, you're hungry, I got something here on the stove, help yourself. Right? He kind of manipulated his brother that way. And then he disguised himself as his brother, tricked his father, and stolen the patriarchal blessing. So this is the memory that Jacob knows he's going to confront in his brother. Right? This is the last thing. These are the last sort of moments that they had in proximity to each other, you know, of Jacob kind of pulling off that stolen blessing. His mother kind of saying, hey, I've heard your brother's not very happy with this. You better leave. And now it's 20 years later. God has told Jacob to come home, but he knows that that's still that open wound, right? That hasn't gone away. So Jacob does a little prep work, right? He does a little work on his own, and he sends in advance, remember, some servants to tell his brother that he's coming. Smart, you don't want to just kind of show up, right? If you can imagine, maybe you've got that, you know, brother-in-law that you have this bad relationship with, and you just kind of show up with your family for a two-week stay one day without doing any phone calling in advance. That's not going to necessarily make it better, right? So he's letting Esau know. And if you remember sort of the funny moment in that is he kind of sends his servants to his brother and say, hey, I'm on my way. And the servants come back and say, oh, great. Well, you slow your pace because he's coming to meet you and he's got an army with him. Right? So Jacob then goes into sort of plan B, which is to send ahead gifts and things like that. He sends breeding stock. He's trying to do everything he can to kind of pacify his brother, lets him know, I've got plenty, I'm not going to be a financial burden, here's some stuff, enjoy. Finally sends his family, kind of thinking about, I'm going to send them as kind of an envoy in advance, maybe seeing them will kind of calm Esau's heart. And then Jacob, after he did that, kind of went across, back across the Jabbok River to be alone. But he wasn't. That was the encounter that we talked about last time, where this angel of the Lord came and wrestled with him and sort of had this wonderful moment of naming in a new name, which will play into our story today. So now it's the morning after, and Jacob has awakened from whatever sleep he got after wrestling with the angel, and he's recrossed the Jabbok River. And it says, then Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. So he divided his children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. And he put the maids and their children in front, and Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. But he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground seven times until he came near to his brother. Then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And he lifted his eyes and saw the women and the children and said, who are these with you? So he said, the children whom God has graciously given your servant. And the maids came near with their children, and they bowed down. And Leah likewise came near with her children, and they bowed down. And afterward, Joseph came near with Rachel, and they bowed down. And he said, what do you mean by all this company which I have met? And he said, to find favor in the sight of my Lord. But Esau said, I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have be your own. Jacob said, no, please. If I have found favor in your sight, then take my present from your hand, for I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably. Please take my gift, which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty. And thus he urged him, and he took it. Then Esau said, well, let us take our journey and go, and I will go before you. But he said to him, my Lord knows that the children are frail, and the flocks and herds which are nursing are a care to me. If they are driven hard one day, all the flocks will die. Please, let my Lord pass on before his servant, and I will proceed at my leisure according to the pace of the cattle that are before me and according to the pace of the children until I come to my Lord at Seir. And Esau said, well, please let me leave some of the people who are with me. But he said, what need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. And Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built for himself a house, and he made booths for his livestock, and therefore the place is named Succoth. And Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. And he came from Paddan Aram and camped before the city. And he bought the piece of land which he had pitched his tent from the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And there he erected an altar, and he called it El Elohe Israel. Well, a story that has a climax and then something of an anti-climax, I suppose. But let's see what we can find here. So again, to be in that moment, it's the morning. Jacob is filthy from wrestling in the dirt. He's tired from his sleepless night. And if you remember, he's limping from his dislocated hip. And he comes across the river, takes a deep breath, and kind of looks up onto the horizon. And what does he see? Behold, Esau coming and 400 men with him. The report of his servants had not been exaggerated. Here comes Esau, and I'm sure Jacob, that 400 doesn't mean he went, wait, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, wait, that little guy, 5, no, he's not counting it, but you get the idea. There's Esau is coming, and he is surrounded by a small army. Who knows what Jacob is thinking at this moment, right? Again, I don't like to conjure up those kinds of feelings, but if you've ever had that moment where you have been in error, and you're about to be held accountable for it, right? Whether that's before a boss, apology to a spouse, whatever. I mean, you just know that's not a great feeling, you know? And I think Jacob is probably feeling some of that. He might also just still be feeling that exhilaration of having been blessed by the angel. Right? So he's probably got a combination of feelings going on inside of him right now. So he sees Esau coming in the distance, and he rejoins his family that he had sent across, and he divided his children. Right? He divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. So remember, he's got Rachel, Leah, Bilhah, and Zilpah, and each of them have their own children through Jacob. And so he's kind of, okay, you two with this one, you four with this one, kind of grouping them up like that. And he has the maids and their children in front, and Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Jacob last. So again, we talked about this a little bit last week. This is sort of in order of their importance to Jacob, right? I mean, the maids and their children, I mean, children are children, sons are sons, but he's got 11 of them, so, you know, there's some room for error here if this goes badly. So we're going to send the maids and their kids first in case Esau's really mad. And then if it comes down to Leah and her children, if he's still mad, but hopefully by the time he gets to Rachel and Joseph, my beloved son, this is the one that we can preserve. And I think that there's, again, just some of the beauty of the language and the writing that I like to bring out once in a while. You notice that Joseph is the only child mentioned by name. Right? There's 11 boys. And the writer doesn't say, you know, the two maids with their sons and then list them. And Leah with her sons and then list them. And then Rachel with her son and list them. Joseph's the only one that gets mentioned. And I think the writer is doing some wonderful things in terms of foreshadowing that continuing dysfunction in this family with Joseph being that special child. Because we know that story coming up, right? We know that story where Joseph gets that coat and his brothers resent him and Joseph has these dreams and then his brothers really resent him. And that winds up being, let's just kill him. I don't like to kill him. Okay, let's just sell him into slavery. That'll do, right? We'll just pretend we killed him. And that leads to Egypt, and that leads to the Exodus, and that leads to the rest of the Old Testament, right? So we get a whisper of that here. We get a whisper of that here. Now, we talked a little bit last time that it could appear that Jacob is hiding behind his children and family, but notice that that's not what happens when it comes to the moment, right? Verse 3. As the party gets close to Esau, Jacob himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground 7 times until he came near his brother. And we see here sort of the first manifestation of this change in Esau, kind of represented last night at the Battle at Peniel, for lack of a better title, right? Esau is going forward. Before this, Esau had sent others first, right? First he sent servants. Then he sends more servants and animals. And he's getting ready to send his wives and kids. And he's ready to do anything but confront Esau face to face. Right? He's like, this is gonna... you go. Right? You go. I can kind of relate to that. I don't like confrontation. Some people do. You might be one of those people that you kind of enjoy that. There's a certain rush that comes from... you know, we're going to take care of this problem. That is not me. So I really am one that is, just shamefully reluctant to confront. So it's easy for me to try to avoid that. But Jacob doesn't do that, right? Jacob puts himself forward. It's almost like he's got everybody lined up, and then he says, wait a second. Let me get up here. He's going to meet Esau first. If Esau's going to take a swing, Jacob's going to be ready. If Esau's going to say attack to his 400 men, Jacob is going to be at the front of the line. That is a great moment, right? Jacob, for the first time in a while, is showing a leadership role. Because leaders go first. Right? Leaders go first. Right? And that's just true in the family. That's true in the workplace. That's just true in the church. You know, leaders don't say, hey, everybody else do this while I do that. Leaders say, do this and I'll show you how. Let me model that for you. So Jacob is stepping up. Now, again, we have to get in this moment. He is stepping up, but he's doing so at a rather slow pace. He's got a dislocated hip. Right? So we need to get that picture. Here's Esau, and he kind of takes him a minute to get to the front of the line because he's not walking very well. But he finally gets up there, and he's going to approach Esau. And what this means is that Esau is going to see him coming, right? Probably for several minutes as he kind of stumbles his way across this field or wherever they are. And as he's approaching, he bows to the ground. Again, we have a moment of irony in Scripture, right? What had been the prophecy, what had been the blessing that Jacob had stolen? May people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master of your brothers and may your mother's sons bow down to you. And when Isaac gave that blessing to Jacob, thinking it was Esau, that whole thing about mother's sons was a pretty small group because there were only two boys. Right? So what Isaac thought he was saying to Esau, but was in fact giving to Jacob, was may Esau bow to you. May he serve you. And now what do we have? We have this moment where that is entirely reversed. It's Jacob going forward, Jacob falling on his face and bowing to his brother. Now, some have struggled with that. Because that doesn't seem to, you know, some people could say, well, that doesn't, you know, that's a contravention of the prophecy or the blessing and stuff like that. So some, even people like John Calvin, have said what really is happening is that Jacob isn't bowing to Esau. The bowing is happening before he gets to Esau, and this is sort of an act of worship. It's like he's praying before he gets to Esau, right? He's bowing down, not to Esau, but on his way to Esau as he's kind of praying. And while that, I mean, that, you know, there's ways to get that out of the language. I don't think that fits the rest of the narrative. Because when Jacob gets to Esau, he is your servant. And Esau is my Lord. And that's not just a token he throws in there. He sticks with that several times in the passage. Right? This is something that's several times in the passage. He continues to refer to himself as your servant. And to Esau as my Lord. This act of bowing and prostrating is a typical cultural symbol of submissiveness. Right? We'll see some of this in the future. I put a couple of examples in here. Remember when Joseph is ruler over the land, he was the one who sold to all the people of the land, and Joseph's brothers came down and bowed to him with their faces before the ground. Again, we'll learn in that narrative. Joseph's brothers are supplicants. They are here. They are begging. And that's what somebody who's begging does. You fall on your face. You fall on your face. You acknowledge your humility. You acknowledge your need. And you are, again, remember the moment. This is potentially a military moment. Jacob has 400 men. Esau has wives and children. And some servants. He is not in the best position anyway. If you remember a couple of weeks ago when Laban confronted Jacob, what did they each do? Built their camps on hillsides in preparation for potential battle. Here, Jacob is not taking up even a defensive posture. He is being the epitome of vulnerability. He is going forward unarmed and bowing down before him. Basically getting down and sticking his neck out. If you want to chop it off, it's here. Another example. Beautiful passage from Ruth's story. Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go on from this one. Stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw." Then Ruth fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner?" Again, this idea of submissiveness, of gratitude, of just being allowed to live. And so Jacob is doing exactly what he ought to do. Jacob knows he's the offending party. And he has come upon his offended brother with a spirit and an action of meekness and contrition. He knows he's wrong, and he's not trying to hide it. And then verse 4. Esau ran to meet him, and embraced him, and fell on his neck, and kissed him, and they wept. I would be certain that as Esau, or Jacob bows, and he looks forward, and Esau comes right at him. And I'll bet Jacob's heart jumped a little bit. Right? Because there is that moment in time, right, between Esau ran to meet him and then embraced him and kissed him and fell on his neck. You know, there's that split second when Jacob is wondering, this is it, right? Here he comes. And you got to remember again with Jacob, he's not going to get away. He's limping. It's not like he can take a chance and say, well, I'll go out here and if things don't go well, then I'll retreat. He's vulnerable. You know, he's hobbling around. He's not going to get away from Esau if Esau attacks him. Esau has come to Jacob in peace. And we get a moment of kind of anticlimax right here, right? I mean, we're ready for, let him have it, and what? This is what goes on? And again, the writing is so quick. Right? There are four verbs right there. He runs to Jacob. He embraces him. He falls on his neck. He kisses him. You read this, and I don't know about you, maybe it's because we went through Luke together. I kind of defaulted as I read this to the prodigal son's return. Right? Where that father, who has every right to just kind of say, you had your inheritance, kid. Live and learn. But instead, what does he do? When he sees his son coming, what's he do? He runs out, right? He's the father is looking to make things right, even though it's the son who's the one that ought to be, right? Remember that wonderful passage. He ran to meet him. He kissed him. He fell on his neck, and they wept together. These kinds of responses, again, we're looking at some cultural things here. Weeping, kissing, these are symbolic of strong family relationships. Different cultures have that. You know, sort of, I was raised, my mom came from Missouri, my dad from Nebraska. They were Depression, World War II kids, you know, that silent generation, as it was called. So, you know, I grew up kind of corn-fed and hand-spanked and just, you know, old-school, white American, you know. And so, you know, we were a very unemotional family. I'm sure my dad loved me. And if he changed his mind, he told me so. But, you know, he didn't need to tell me that. You know, that was just how it was, right? That was just, and it wasn't, I know, I was a very loved child. I'm not disparaging my parents at all. But, I mean, that was just our dynamic, right? Our family dynamic, our cultural dynamic, sort of Midwestern America, mid-20th century upbringing was, you know, you just don't show emotion, guys. Especially guys. Guys just don't do that, you know? My wife is Cuban. That is different. Right? They are very affectionate. They are very loud. They are very demonstrative of their emotions. And that was kind of a culture shock for me. Right? Because, you know, they can yell at each other and love at each other. And they laugh and they cry and they're boisterous. And they hug and they kiss. And that's just what everybody does. And it was kind of a weird thing when I got into that role. You know, it just took a little bit of learning, right? It's a cultural thing. This is something typical of this culture, right? We saw this before, ironically. It said when Laban heard the news of Jacob, his sister's son, this is when Rachel first tells Laban Jacob's in town, Laban ran to meet him, embraced him, kissed him, brought him to his house, right? I just know your family. That's all it takes. Come on in. Remember when Joseph finally meets Benjamin again? He fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. And Benjamin wept on his neck. And he kissed all his brothers and wept on them. And they talked together. Right? There's this sense that that's okay. So you see essentially what's happening. My point here is that the differences between the two are being put aside and being replaced and overwhelmed by their commonality, right? This is who we are. We're brothers. And in brothers in this culture, this is what you do. Now, while that happens, that was hardly what we expected from Esau, right? I have a hard time feeling, if you'd never heard this story and you were just reading through the narrative, that would be what you would expect, right? You would not expect, after all of this preparation that Jacob has gone through, for the next part of the narrative to be, and Esau said, hey, it's all good, right? You're expecting something else. And Scripture doesn't tell us why. Right? We don't have a little byline in here that says, well, Esau got a vision from God saying, don't mess with your brother. Right? I mean, Abimelech got one of those. Laban got one of those. Remember when Laban's pursuing Jacob? And God comes to Laban and says, yeah, don't you dare. Right? Don't you dare. This one's mine. And Laban's like, oh, all right. You know, I'm going to talk some smack to him anyway, but I can't hit him. But all right. Maybe Jacob doesn't know that, so I can puff up my chest and make him feel like I'm going to. Right? We don't have any stories like that. So we don't know why this happens. And it's clear from the narrative that what Esau's doing is not trying to fake his brother out, right? This isn't sort of some sort of subterfuge where he's kind of told his 400 men, look, I'm going to pretend like it's all good, and then tonight you're going to get in. This is genuine. Right? This is genuine reconciliation on his part. But I do think it's worth making the point that even though we can't point to a verse where it says, and God told Esau this, we all know how God works in our hearts. Right?
Yep.
And for any of us who have been the offended party, let's hop over into Esau's role now. If you have been the offended party, I think we're all spiritually mature enough to know that if we are able to come to a place of forgiveness, that's not just because we're good people. That's the work of the Lord in our heart. Right? If we can forgive somebody, it's not because we're that good. It's because God is giving grace and mercy to us, allowing us to be forgiving. Because if we're left to our own selfish stuff, we want retribution. Right? We want payback. I might forgive you, but I'm going to forgive you after I make it even. Right? Then we're good. Okay? I don't forgive you when I'm one down. This is God's work in Esau's heart, just like it's God's work in ours. Now, I am sure Jacob is surprised at what's happening right now. I imagine there's also a little bit of surprise in Esau. Because again, we'll stay with Esau for a minute and kind of be in his place. I am sure, we've talked about this before, that even though they are separated by a few hundred miles, they must have had word from each other. People went back and forth on these caravan routes. I'm sure news had spread a little bit. But the last time Esau saw Joseph, he was 20 years younger. Jacob, he was 20 years younger. He was a lot poorer. And frankly, he looked a lot better. Right? I mean, Jacob is all messed up, disheveled, and limping. So I'm sure Esau's like, what in the world happened to you? And that's sort of what the questions are. He doesn't talk about the limp. He's just going to kind of let that go. But he asks about his family. He says, who are these with you? And Jacob kind of reverts to old Jacob here. He talks about the children. He doesn't talk about his wives. Right? Jacob doesn't start the introductions, well, here's Leah and Rachel and then the middle, you know, he skips over them. He talks about his children. Why doesn't he talk about his wives? Well, I think Jacob is wisely catching himself and going, if we talk about the wives, that's going to bring it back to the time I left to go get a wife. That's going to remind Esau why I left. Let's not look under that rock just yet. Right? Right now, Esau's in a pretty good mood. We're hugging and kissing and having this family reunion. Let's not rip the Band-Aid off that little scar just now. So he skips over that and he says, the children whom God has given me. And at this moment in my mind, what I see Jacob remembering is an answer to a prayer. What did he pray? Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he will come and attack me and the mothers and the children. That was the prayer just the night before. And now Jacob is saying, these are the children God has given me. He's getting God up front. And then, it doesn't say so, but I get the feeling Jacob kind of gave a nod to everybody to say, I think the coast is clear, come forward. Everybody comes forward, right? His wives come forward, again, in this descending order of affection, right? The maids came near with their children, they bowed down. Leah came near with her children and bowed down. And afterwards, Joseph came near with Rachel and bowed down. And, you know, these children, they're called children, but remember, this has been 20 years. So some of these are young men. Some of these are young men. And they're meeting their uncle Esau. And Jacob, I imagine, is off to the side watching, remembering that these are the children whom God has graciously given. And then there's a lot that isn't in the narrative that, as my historian self kind of steps up, I wish there was there. We don't get a lot right now. We don't get any conversation between Esau and the siblings. Right? Did they make any small talk? Did Esau ask him any questions? No, we don't have much there. There's nothing. There's no conversation. Maybe they just stepped forward and bent to the ground and we don't have that. We also know that Jacob is not giving out a lot of detail. Again, this is old Jacob, right? He's not talking about why he has two wives. There's a story, right? Let me tell you, brother, what went on? Well, there was this time when I thought I was marrying Rachel, and it turned out I woke up in the morning and it was Leah, and oh my word, was I surprised. He kind of leaves all that out. Doesn't talk a lot about Uncle Laban, right? We're not getting a lot of narrative out of Jacob. He's not going to talk about trickery or being tricked or tricking others, because these are not things that he wants to remind Esau that happened. Right? Because that's just going to throw Esau back to, oh, you got tricked. Oh, about right, you got tricked, because you know what you did with me. Remember, you know, he doesn't want to go down that road. So he's keeping his cards close to his vest. Something else Jacob never does in this whole passage is apologize. Right? At no point does Jacob say, hey, Esau, I'm sorry I stole the birthright. Should have just given you the stew. And that whole blessing thing, let's go find Dad. I need to make that right. At no point does that happen. At no point does that happen. Which I think is worth noting, because it is a reminder to us that if we are the offended party, we can forgive without the other person asking for forgiveness. All right? We can forgive without the other person asking for forgiveness. Esau asks some more questions. Right? He's met everybody. Kind of has the family sorted out. And then he says, well, what do you mean by all this company? You know, what is all the animals and stuff that you've been sending to me? Now, I'm sure that the servants delivered the message that Jacob instructed, right? So in other words, Esau has been told, hey, these are gifts to you from your brother. So he's not asking out of sort of total ignorance. But I think what's going on here is Esau is aware of the fact that, try to say this right, Jacob is surprised Esau is forgiving him, right? I think Esau is aware of that. In other words, Esau knew Jacob wasn't coming to him expecting to be forgiven, right? Esau knows that what he's doing is not what Jacob expected. And while I appreciate all these gifts, that seems like a lot. Are you sure? Because I really am forgiving you. You don't need to sort of buy your way out of this, I think, is the dynamic that's happening here. I know you're probably surprised that it's all good between us, but, and I appreciate all the gifts, but, you know, you don't need to do this, is really a way we're doing this. And Jacob answers honestly, right? He doesn't try any kind of any way of rewording this that's anything other than the honest statement of, why did I do all this? To find favor in the sight of my Lord. And again, that's a language convention that is intentional, to find favor in your sight. If I have found favor in your sight is a phrase we met before. It's a way of acknowledging deference. It's a way of acknowledging you're in the wrong and they are superior. And it's a way of sort of begging forgiveness. Right? And then the dialogue kind of goes into one of those dialogues that Christian men have when they're out to dinner with their wives and each one wants to pick up the check. Right? You want to kind of out-gracious the other guy. No, I got this. No, you bet. I got this. No, you got it. I got it. You know, you're trying to out-nice the other guy. Right? Because that's sort of what happens here. Esau said, I have plenty. My brother, let what you have be your own. Jacob said, no, please. If I have found favor in your sight, take my present from my hand, for I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably. Take my gift, which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty. And he urged him, and Esau took it. Notice that Esau calls Jacob my brother. Jacob isn't there yet. Jacob does not call Esau his brother. Jacob continues to call Esau my Lord. And I think that's just Jacob not quite sure yet. Right? He's not quite sure yet. Esau doesn't take the gift at first, not because he's being rude. Again, these are social conventions where each one tries to be gracious. Right? I think what also might be going on is Esau wants Jacob to know that I don't need your gift. Right? Remember, in this culture, that birthright and blessing meant that Esau would have inherited twice the amount Jacob would have inherited as the firstborn son. The firstborn son got double. Right? And now those roles are in theory reversed. And I think Esau is letting Jacob know, you know, even though I didn't get the portion I should have and you cheated me out of it, I'm good. I don't need these animals. I think that's what's going on here. But Jacob makes a couple of points. He couches his argument with sort of two prongs. And the first one is when he says, if now I have favor in your sight, take my gift. In other words, what Jacob is trying to insist upon Esau is that this gift of mine, if you accept it, that's the sign of forgiveness. That's how I know this is legit. That's how I know that this is not just words. Right? If you take my gift, that will be the sign that you have really forgiven me. That will be the sign that you have forgiven me. And secondly, Jacob is letting Esau know, I too have been blessed. I know I went out of here with not even enough money to pay for my wife. I had to work for my dowry, but I have been blessed, right? And I think, and again, this is maybe my less honorable qualities, but I also think Jacob is letting Esau know that being blessed by God is a good thing, and Esau, just in case you really aren't serious about forgiving me, you don't want to mess with somebody that's being blessed by God. Remember, we've seen that before with Laban and Abimelech and some others, where that hand is put out there like, you know, I am blessing. God, of course, sort of tells them in their dream, I'm blessing Abraham. Don't mess with it. So I think Jacob might be saying, I'm blessed by God. God's got his hand on me. God's showing me his favor. So in case this is sort of a ruse to kind of get me alone, just know that. And then I'm going to go back to something I hinted at last week that I said I would talk about again today. And here we are, so we're going to talk about it. Jacob acknowledges he is blessed by God. And he is acknowledging that not based on his circumstances. Because his circumstances are still precarious. Right? It seems like Esau has forgiven him. But let's face it, at any moment, Esau can raise his hand and those 400 men move in, and Jacob's story ends in a minute. Jacob is very vulnerable, and yet he is blessed by God. And that's just a reminder. A reminder that our being blessed by God is not related to our circumstances. It's not related to our circumstances. Jacob also uses a phrase here that's worth seeing. Jacob says, to see you, he's talking to Esau, is as one sees the face of God. And it's a reminder. We just saw that line, right, last night. When Jacob was wrestling with the angel, right? He said, I have seen the face of God and I have lived. This is, I think, in Jacob's mind, an intentional play on words. You know, Peniel has become Peniesau. Not because Esau has undergone some metamorphosis. But again, what did that mean? I have seen the face of God and lived. That's what Jacob said last night. And what is Jacob saying this morning? I've seen the face of Esau and lived. Right? I've confronted my brother. I've come before him and I've been forgiven. I think Jacob is intentionally remembering that message. Well, it seems like the reconciliation is going well. Certainly it is from Esau's side. And he kind of thinks that, okay, you're back and we're all good. So let's move on together. They're going to share hospitality, probably live together. Why not, right? That's what Abraham and Lot had done. So Esau says, let's take our journey and go. I'll go before you. So Esau is offering to accompany the caravan. He's offering to provide 400 men to kind of, hey, my army is at your service. You know, there might be marauders. We'll protect you and we'll go forward and we'll get you safely to Seir where I live. And Jacob refuses. Right? What does Jacob say? He says, my Lord knows the children are frail, the flocks and herds which are nursing are a care to me. If they're driven hard one day, all the flocks will die. So let my Lord pass on before his servant. I will proceed at my leisure according to the pace of the cattle that are before me and according to the pace of the children, and I will come to my Lord at Seir. So Jacob's kind of making this point, like, that. Thank you. That's great. I appreciate us moving on together, but I can't keep up. Right, I've got the wives and the kids. Again, this is a time when people walk everywhere. You had animals. You might have animals for riding, but really that was for the very old and infirm or the very young, because riding an animal takes a much greater toll on that animal than it just sort of walking at its pace. So you really didn't do that. You kind of walked alongside your animals as they walked, to not place a burden on them. Remember, we're 500 miles into this journey through a desert. So this is a long, hard journey. So everybody's walking, right? And while some of Jacob's sons are older, some obviously are younger, right? And there's only a certain pace they can go. And you've got the animals, and the nursing young are not going to be able to keep up with their mothers. And that means they're not going to be able to nurse. And that means they're going to die. And that's not good. So he's making a very valid point here. He's making a very valid point, and I think that's one that Esau kind of understands, right? Where we've come a long way, we've got a long way to go, and this isn't going to work. And Jacob is saying, don't worry, I'm going to come to you in Seir. I'm not going to go anywhere else. I mean, if you're a little worried about me being back here and what I'm going to do, now that I'm in town, I'm coming to you. I'll stay where you can keep an eye on me if that's important. So I'll be right there. And Esau gets it. He accepts his point. I mean, he's surrounded by all these animals and children, so it's kind of hard to ignore it, right? But he offers another, makes a counterproposal. He says, well, let me leave some men with you, some of the people who are with me. Well, it's okay. Yeah, that makes sense. But I'll tell you what, let me give you 50 guys. I can call off a couple of groups, and they'll stay with you. They'll provide protection and help you with your flocks, and, you know, we'll kind of help you get on your way. Well, this presents a bit more of a problem to Jacob, because he really doesn't have an argument now, right? I mean, I think what you're probably seeing is that Jacob has no intention of going to Seir. That is not where he's going. But how does he not go there, right? He doesn't want to go with Esau, because if he goes with Esau, that's where they're going to go. And if Esau leaves some men with him, they're going to make sure he goes there. So Jacob's got to find a way out of this, and he really doesn't have an argument. I mean, why shouldn't he just accept the help, right? You can play the weak and the young card in the first argument, but that's not going to work here. Because Jacob's saying, yeah, take your extra time, I'll just leave some guys to help you. So Jacob doesn't even offer a response, right? He doesn't offer a rebuttal to the argument. He simply says, you know, what need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord. In other words, he doesn't have a good argument, so he's simply trying to say, no, please, just, if you'll be gracious to me and just let it go. He doesn't have an argument. He has no intention of going there. This moment kind of ends, showing that Jacob is still capable of being deceptive, and Esau hasn't learned a thing. He's still capable of being tricked. And so the brothers part on friendly terms. Apparently Esau accepts his argument because nothing else is said. What we do have is the next day it says, Esau returned on that day on his way to Seir, and Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built for himself a house and made booths for his livestock. And I have a little map there that if you can see it, sorry about the small print, but it's the best I could do. Edom, Seir, as we know, is in the very south of Palestine. It's not in the land of Canaan. Right, it's on the opposite side of the Dead Sea, Jordan River area, and it's well in the south. Jacob has come from the far north, Paddan Aram, and they have met at this place along the around Succoth, the Jabbok River. And Jacob has promised Esau, I'll go with you all the way to the south. I'll follow you to your land. That's not where he's going to go. He's instead going to hang a right turn for himself and go across the Jordan into Canaan and stay at Shechem. Right, so that's what Jacob is going to do. There's no formal treaty. There's nothing sort of binding between the two. I think that's a wonderful moment that they've just been able to work this out together. But it's clear that Jacob has no intention of going all the way to the southern border. That's not his land. That's not the land he's been promised. And so at this moment, Jacob and Esau part. And there is no further mention of them together again in Scripture until they bury their father years later. We don't know if they ever communicated or whatever happens. Now, we don't know, just like we don't know why Esau decided to forgive Jacob, we also don't know specifically why Jacob misled his brother. If you're kind of on Jacob's side in this, you can argue that, well, you know, he's simply obeying God, right? God had come to him, and when he originally told him to return to Canaan, that's exactly what he said, right? He said, return to the land of your fathers and your relatives, and I will be with you. So Jacob, it's not like he's deceiving Esau. He's obeying God. You know, if he goes to Seir, to Edom, he's not in the land of Canaan. He's not going to the land God told him to go to. So really, Jacob is just being an obedient believer in God. And that's true. But you still wonder, why didn't Jacob just tell Esau that? You know, when Esau says, hey, you know, why don't we travel together? That's a good time for Jacob to go, actually, the Lord has spoken to me, and I'm not supposed to live down there in Seir and Edom. I'm supposed to go over here to Canaan and take up residence. Why doesn't he say that? Well, it very well may be that he doesn't know that Esau is going to trust him that much. He might be just reluctant to cause any negative feelings. I mean, everything is going very well right now. Right, and if you've been in that kind of moment where everybody's saying yes to everybody, nobody wants to be the first one to say no. Right, we're all getting along, we're all in agreement. He doesn't want to do something like that. Later on, here is an explanation given in Scripture. This is a few chapters down the road. But later on it will be explained that Esau took his wives and his sons and his daughters and all his household and his livestock and all his cattle and his goods which he had acquired in Canaan, and went to another land away from his brother Jacob. For their property had become so great for them to live together, and the land where they sojourned could not sustain them because of their livestock. So Esau lived in the hill country Seir. Esau is Edom. So this kind of paints the picture that the reason the boys don't live together now is because they're going to have that whole Abraham Lot problem of there's just too much stuff. That might be an argument at the time. But again, that might mean that just everything everybody's saying is formality. You know, everybody's making the offer and hoping nobody accepts, right? No, stay. No, really, we can't. Okay, good. You know, thank goodness. Well, we don't know how long Jacob remains there at Succoth, but it's not to be his permanent place of residence. For one thing, Succoth is not in Canaan either, right? So it's temporary. They build these things called booths that are temporary dwellings. And he's probably, now that the moment with Esau has passed and Esau has left, I'm sure what Jacob is doing is just taking time to regroup, right? It has been a long, hard journey from Canaan. To Canaan from Paddan Aram. He's had to deal with Laban. He's had that confrontation. Now he's had this confrontation with Esau. So it might be good just to take a little bit of time, and it's an undetermined amount of time, to let the animals rest up, to let the people rest up, before we move forward. And so eventually he does. Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram. And he camped before the city, and he bought a piece of land there, where he had pitched his tent, from the hand of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And they erected an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. Shechem, if you remember, was the place where Abraham, on his original journey to Canaan, many years before, stopped temporarily. He had built an altar there. It's about 40 miles north of Jerusalem. It's on a crossroads of trade routes, and I'm sure Jacob is just kind of following one of those trade routes as he goes there. Now this Shechem is a small city, and it's controlled by these people, the sons of Hamor. And Jacob has purchased some land. We don't know why. Some commentators think it's that same reason that Abraham bought land, a future burial site. He's planning on staying, is the point being made here. Jacob is back in Canaan, and Jacob is going to stay here. We don't know how much he paid for it, 100 pieces of money. That's kind of hard to figure out, but we know what he did with it. He built an altar on it. This is something Jacob will do again. It's something he'd seen his father and his grandfather do. Jacob is coming back to a place where God has told him to come, and he is building an altar. And the only reason you built an altar is if you are going to worship. Right? If you are going to worship. And that's the part of this passage I want to close with, because I want to look at the name Jacob gives to this place. Jacob gives it a name which means God is the God of Israel. God is the God of Israel. And it's easy to read that and to think, well, of course he is Israel, the nation, right? But that's not the Israel we're talking about here. That Israel doesn't exist. The Israel we're talking about is Jacob, right? What he's really saying is God is my God. This is no longer the God of my fathers, right? The God of Abraham and the God of Isaac. Now it is the God of Israel. That's me. That's my new name. That's the name the Lord gave me last night. Remember a couple of decades ago when Jacob was fleeing, he had a dream, and there was this ladder to heaven. And the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord your God, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac, the land on which you lie. And I will give it to you and your descendants. Your descendants will also be like the dust of the earth. And you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until what I have done, what I have promised you. This was that great promise given to Abraham, given to Isaac, now repeated to Jacob, that God made as Jacob was beginning on this 20-year adventure that he had no idea was going to be a 20-year adventure. And now Jacob is back. Again, let's go back 20 years. What did Jacob do the morning after that dream? This is what Jacob said. Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me on my journey that I take, and give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. We're back. So this reconciliation is not just about Jacob and Esau. It's about Jacob and God. They are, once again, one. They are once again at peace with each other. They have fulfilled. God has always fulfilled his promises. And now Jacob is fulfilling his. Jacob is saying, this is my God. I don't know. Again, we kind of started this by thinking about a moment in a relationship where maybe you have offended somebody. I want to kind of wrap up, I think, a great takeaway from this. There's a couple. On the very sort of Jacob-Esau level, there's that human broken relationship in which maybe we have been the offending party. And if that's you, this is a great time to make that right. It will not get any easier to make it right. If you've had that experience, the longer you go, it doesn't go away. Right? It just gets worse. If you are the offended party, this is a great time to forgive. Even if the other person hasn't apologized. I am sure I'm not the only person that's had this experience. And when I had this experience, it taught me how destructive not forgiving was to me. I had been offended by somebody back in the day, and they had never really done anything about it. And I carried a lot of resentment about that. Only realized that years later, that person had no idea they had ever offended me. Right? When we finally kind of talked it out, they had no idea that I had been bitter for this many years. It hadn't bothered them at all. They had no idea it had happened. It just ate away at me. There's nothing in that. There is no future in not forgiving. Perhaps the application today is less a Jacob-Esau thing and a Jacob-God thing. Now, in this case, it's a little easier to figure out who's at fault, isn't it? If there's a break in the relationship between you and God, that's on you. You know, God didn't mess it up. God didn't offend you. God didn't prove unfaithful. But again, stepping forward and asking forgiveness is the way to go. Well, Lord, we'll leave it there. And just thank you for the truth of Scripture. Thank you for the lessons that it teaches so many years later that are still so true. Because you are still the same God you always were. You are the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and you are our God. And Lord, I just thank you for forgiveness. I thank you for your grace and mercy that you generously pour out upon us when we offend you. I just pray that however this seems to fit into our lives today, a few dozen of us here, that you would just help it to be useful. Help it to be something that we appropriate to ourselves for our own sanctification and for your glory. Amen.